person who okays biological weapons should not cry about the stench of new diseases. The one who cuts off the trees so the orangutans can't hang should not wonder about ecological devastation. It's not what's up that's going down, it's what's down that's going up. It's not what's up that's going down, it's what's down that's going up, that's going up.
Hello, hello. You're listening to Darshiv on WHUS Stores. Today we're going to be talking about archives, black arts, some spoken word poetry, pretty funky stuff. Today my guest is fellow archivist Melissa Waterworth Batt. She works alongside me. My name is Graham. I'm also an archivist. We work together at the Archives and Special Collections at the Thomas J. Dodd Research Center here at the University of Connecticut Storrs campus. On this show, we highlight resources that we have access to, electronic, digital things you can find online, but also directly in our reading room through the University of Connecticut Library. Melissa, welcome to the show.
Hello, Graham. Hello, everyone. It's great to be here today.
Melissa oversees the literary collections that we have, which are extensive. Today we're going to be talking, I think, about one portion of them. But Melissa, could you tell me a little bit about what you oversee, what you do at the archives?
Sure. Well, I'm an archivist, as you are, Graham, and we are here on campus really to preserve preserve culture, preserve the history of not only the university, but of course, American culture. And we, in our collecting practice, have been, at least in the literary collections, preserving primarily poetry post-war, post-World War II, and then providing access to it for students, for faculty, for anyone to enjoy. I should mention, too, Graham, one great thing about doing the radio show is we want to make it clear to students that we'd love to talk about these things and play these things for you, but the experience of actually listening to these materials or viewing them, handling them yourself in the archives, I think, is not to be missed. So people talk a lot about the authentic experience. Well, we invite you all to come to the archives to engage and experience these things that I talk about today too. So
that's right.
We should quickly mention that the archives is open 9 to 4 Monday through Fridays. We are located in the Dodd Research Center, and of course, with all your free time, please do stop in and come check out what we're all about and what we have for you to enjoy on your own. It could be related to a class, or it could be just some personal interest you want to look into and explore. So yeah, I'm here to talk about the literary collections, but more importantly, I think talk more about sort of where we're actively trying to build the collections today. The strength of the literary collections is really on, as I mentioned, post-war American poetry, and primarily, if you will, around three sort of poetry movements. One is called the Beat Poetry Movement. The second one's called the Black Mountain Poetry Movement, and the third one is called the New York School Poetry Movement. These all took place after World War II, and were sort of unique and formative in their own ways. But they're relevant for us today to talk about sort of the Black Arts Movement and experimental music and text today. because almost all of those poetry movements incorporated sound and performance as a part of their text, if you will. Some of our listeners may know of the Beats, Allen Ginsberg, Lenny Bruce, of course, John Kerouac, many of whom, particularly Kerouac, sought out jazz performers to work with. Some of that has been recorded and is on vinyl and is available in the music library on campus. But I think the important point is that Kerouac really saw those collaborations as spontaneous and as works within themselves. So keep that in mind as we're talking today. The literary, I should just mention quickly, the literary collections encompass, of course, printed texts, some of which are very rare and only exist in little magazines of the time period, which we have. And they also encompass manuscripts, so the original, say, Kerouac handwritten version of some of his poetry we have. But we also have recordings of poets reading their work, and this is important because these are really considered, you know, unique versions or a version of a poet's work. And we're getting more and more requests to see what we have in the collections from students who are interested in some of the poets and writers that they have been hearing about through contemporary either art or pop music and other sort of, musical and art text performance pieces going on right now, experimental artistic movements.
And we're going to listen to some of those today, aren't we? Excellent. Can you tell us a little bit about the first song that we heard before we got into the show? Who was that?
Sure. That was Jane Cortez and her Fire Spitters Band. Her recordings, Jane Cortez is considered one of the participants in the Black Arts Movement of the 1960s. She performed her poetry and her band performed her work throughout mainly the Detroit and the New York areas. She performed live a lot at different actions and political protests. So that piece was called Endangered Species List Blues, Jane Cortez.
Yeah, I definitely liked that combination of, you know, there's a jazz ensemble in the back. Did you say she was playing drums?
She's playing drums, yeah.
That's amazing. I know we also have some of her work when she spoke here on this campus. Some of this stuff is hosted in our digital repository, which you can find at archives.lib.ucon.edu, which is a free service. Anybody can access that material. But we have a lot of her spoken word in digital format.
That's
hosted
right.
There.
Mm-hmm. And those recordings were when Jane Cortez came to UConn, right, several times at the invitation of faculty to perform and be interviewed by students at the time. And I think it was in the 70s when she came to campus several times. So those are very cool recordings.
Which is part of a larger, this Black Arts, this experience in the Black Arts program that we had here at UConn. And if you try and find some of Jane's stuff in the repository, you also come across all kinds of other artists, visual artists, performance artists, spoken word artists. So there's a lot of different kind of material that this relates to literary-wise. But I think some of the stuff that, Melissa, you oversee is kind of different from the material that I oversee because there is so much more performance in this. Mm-hmm. Which leads to different kinds of recordings in a way, certainly beyond the traditional notion of a paper-based archive where everything is about the written word.
That's
and
right.
This performance side of things I find interesting. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how did collecting start in this area?
Okay, in the literary collections?
Mm-hmm. And in the Black Arts as well.
In the Black Arts. The literary collections we began collecting back in the late 1960s with the work of Charles Olson. Charles Olson, at that point, was considered ahead of his time, also in some ways an experimenter of poetry. He is considered the major voice in the Black Mountain Poets poetry movement, if you will. His poetics encompassed free verse, what he would call free verse, or projective verse. So that is poetry that relates to itself, that performs, if you will. And so this was a very new idea, and many subsequent poets reference Charles Olson as an influence in, say, subsequent poetry movements like the language poetry movement, or even the Cambridge School of Poetry. But what we found over the years is that, of course, that wasn't the only poetry movement happening. And so the archivists over the years have tried to document the other sort of poetry movements happening at the same time as the Black Mountain. And so the Beats are included, as well as the New York School poets such as Frank O'Hara. And then moving into the 70s, these kinds of spoken arts really started fomenting and sort of emerging out of some of the cities. And so this is where Amiri Baraka, who, as Leroy Jones, was considered an early publisher and also poet in sort of the Black College, the Black Mountain College sort of poetry, moved on to writing his own sort of what were then called the Black Arts Movement poetry. He also wrote primarily plays at that time. So we have over the years moved from sort of collecting what you might consider in these sort of academic literary categories to being much more open to collecting spoken word in different formats, not just in print. And then, of course, to reflect much more diverse voices in the archive. So this is where the alternative press comes in, Graham, that you oversee, is a lot of the voices coming out in the 70s and 60s were being published in alternative press publications. Some of these were pretty ephemeral or one-off. Sometimes poets were simply performing live, and these weren't captured at all in print, other than to have people who went to this event or this happening to write about it in their alternative newspaper. And then lastly, the only other sort of document we have of sort of what we would call the spoken arts would be flyers, you know. And right now, you know, we have flyers of lots of musical performance, punk rock, and these flyers sometimes are the only document we have that these happenings, that these spontaneous performances took place. So we've really moved and expanded and diversified this archive, and this work continues for sure.
Right.
So I should mention how students are really driving us to move in this area. We teach a lot of classes, and I listen very closely to not only what students are reading, but what they're listening to. And so then when they do come to class, I particularly English classes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we do classes around poetry for art and art history, of course, English and English composition, but also we host the Long River Review editing group. And then, of course, student groups. From the cultural centers are free to come in, of course, and just read our publications. But students are really asking for people like Jane Cortez, which is why I wanted to play her today.
Mm-hmm.
They're rediscovering people like Nikki Giovanni and Audre Lorde. These were women whose artistic sort of work and practices emerged from these 1970s liberation movements. Particularly radical feminist poetry is really flourishing in performance, particularly in the 70s and 80s. And Audre Lorde, you know, is not only writing, but she's publishing work. She's conducting teaching. She's doing a lot of activism at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to collect all of that again to try to reflect for students, you know, Audre Lorde as a full, as a woman, as an artist, as an activist.
Right.
And we want to be able to provide that for them in the context, right, in which Audre Lorde was producing at the time. They're asking, I think, too, for, you know, for other Black arts writers and musicians, Mary Baraka, of course, Alice Coltrane, Sonia Sanchez. They want to read their work, but also hear their performance work. So that's pretty cool. And I should say, too, that really what's driving us as well is a lot of wonderful cultural critique, but also cultural writing about how these liberation movements are, of course, relevant today, right? How do we today kind of look at the relationship between literature and community? How does community drive literature? How does literature evolve from the written word to the spoken word? So this is really interesting right now, particularly in our own cultural moment.
And you kind of mentioning the political aspect of, you know, an entirely women-produced, women-performed, women-organized output of this kind of work. I mean, that seems to be inherently activist. It seems inherently political. And in that sense, you know, how can people try and access these collections for their own interpretation, you know, in terms of like using it as a performative base? Do you see any kind of relationship to the activist work that we have that ties in with this stuff? I know the production itself is activist, but...
Right. Well, I can say, of course, one theme that is really important to understand, and I tell students this, that being an activist meant that you were in control of your own product, your own cultural production, meaning your own printing or your own performance, your own travel. You wanted to be a participant in the community. You didn't just want to perform in a community. You wanted them to participate in your work. And then also, too, there was definitely this relationship at the time between someone's activism and how do I say what they, their choices in terms of expression, poetry, spoken word, is it printed word, do I do a street performance, is this theater? This makes sense if you think of, it's really vital for understanding these kinds of choices when we consider community-based artistic practices that today people kind of take for granted, but back, say, in San Francisco during the era of AIDS activism, some very distinct cultural work come out of that and are today, like I said, being used, maybe not necessarily understanding the origins of, for instance, the relationship between sort of collective memory and mourning and the AIDS activism and artwork that came out at that time period. So it's queer performance, it's gay theater, it's street art. Okay, it's Keith Haring doing spontaneous sort of calligraphy, you know, I wouldn't call it calligraphy, I don't know, wall art and so forth. So those things really come out of the 70s and 80s. Also things like a lot of today's artists, and particularly Black poets, really referenced this Dark Room Collective, which was a reading series in Cambridge in the 1980s. So poets like Sharon Strange, Kevin Young, and Marcus Wicker today are really trying to educate people that listen to their work and read their work about these earlier generation of sort of writers and poets working in different cities. So again, that's sort of something interesting we want students to understand, and we're trying to bridge the different collections and archives and special collections and hopefully write the products of their cultural work. I don't know, your pamphlet, your poetry reading works together with the alternative press, the underground newspapers, right? The chapbooks, and then the flyers, something as ephemeral as posters for for a performance. So.
Exactly. And that idea of the ephemerality of a lot of these movements in and of themselves, I find really fascinating because, as we've discussed before, if there is not a produced piece in the traditional sense, then how do we go about thinking of recording these things? If there is no physical recording, mm-hmm. and you had mentioned a couple of performers themselves who would just kind of all of a sudden, almost like a pop-up performance, mm-hmm. you know, where there's no planning on really anybody's part to try and document what this is. Yeah, what kind of challenges, I guess, do you face when you try and think about, I want a holistic archive that is going to contain, you know, all the pieces that lead to this person's production? What happens when nobody records anything?
Right. Well, you have to really, first of all, listen to the people who are participating in that art. So, for instance, and then you have to, this is a difficult thing to express, but you understand the silences are going to be there. You understand the fragmentary nature, right, of memory and also of history. So what I guess we try to do is just keep building and adding documents. And by that, I mean really thinking of the document in the most in the broadest sense you can. And a document is, like I said, different media, but it could be a literal, you know, video of the performance. It could be lyrics of a song. So I think, right, part of what we do is think, of course, more broadly about what the document is. And, of course, just listen to these performers themselves, to what they're saying and how, what do I want to say, what choices they're making in terms of how they're going to express, or even how they want to realize their own work. And this all sounds very high-minded, but what it just means is, like, I think I was telling you, when you go to a Sun Ra show, I have been to Sun Ra shows, and of course I listen to those shows that have been recorded. But what people miss, and that you have to see when Hope's in the surviving film footage or firsthand, you know, sort of interviews or even reviews of the show, is to know that Sun Ra had a big expectation. That orchestra wanted you to participate. And those shows would sometimes go on for hours, 4 or 5 hours. And it's because you had to commit yourself to taking this journey with the orchestra. And then you were expected to walk away and to produce something of your own, to act or to react to the art that you just experienced, or to the experience you mm-hmm. just experienced. And so I think by even today, listening to some of these experimental music and experimental, I guess you could call it performance, it helps me then build the archive better. And again, listening to the young people today who are consuming those sort of cultural, you know, works, listen to what they're saying and how they're consuming that, and then try as you can to be more active in preserving that document. So like I said, you just have to kind of use the tools you have and then be very active in soliciting and building up the gaps, filling the gaps in the collection.
Right. Which is, yeah, that is definitely the kind of work that all archives face, basically, mm-hmm. is trying to create this complete record, or as complete as you can. I mean, the absolute complete record is never going to be there, right? There's erasure,
right.
And there's all these ways that history has sort of been unrecorded and forgotten. But in a way, this is an interesting part of the work that we do, mm-hmm. I guess, in trying mm-hmm. to make sure that any angle that we can try and cover is represented in that collection.
That's right.
Can I also just mention how freaking jealous I am that you've seen Sun Ra?
And
can I also have you tell us who they played with?
Well, the one time, you know, it was back in the late 80s, so I remember one performance was in New York City, and it was a part of a very large street festival. And what was great is that part of it, Sun Ra played in the street, and there was a lot of marching and participatory, you had to participate in this piece happening. So in that way, it was, it was a show, but it was also part of a bigger protest. And then, but later I saw Sun Ra at Brown University. They had performed, I think, on the same bill with Sonic Youth. And I'm pretty sure that was in the early 90s, but I think I told you it's difficult to find those recordings, right, at all. All I have is my memory that I was there. And again, I did see some fanzines that had pictures from the show. So it's sort of documenting that had happened. Memoir isn't always reliable, but apparently, some of the members of Sonic Youth have written recently about their own lives, and it's possible that, of course, that they would have more information about what it was like to interact with Sun Ra.
Right.
But what an interesting collective, and I have to say that I think having participated in that work and being a part of it, I definitely, when I hear bands like today, Burnt Sugar, the orchestra, or... I don't know, More Mother, I think I was going to talk about later today. But some of these, even Afrofuturism artists, they sort of directly reference some of that experience that I had being in the Sun Ra audience. What a prolific, too, band they were. Just and spontaneous, showing up and performing.
That is such a cool, and the overlap of them being, number one with like this very hip band, Sonic Youth, which I feel like I can just see the demographic at a Sonic Youth show. And then here is Sun Ra, the complete opposite.
Yeah. And you wonder, was it Thurston Moore? I mean, how did they connect? Were they just together on the Lower East Side in New York? Or, you wonder what scene sort of prompted that collaboration. Mm-hmm. But, Sun Ra has played with many, other bands over the years.
Right.
And
which I find
was
interesting, because this is like, and then to see them at a political moment, like to see them come out and literally performing, most likely in alliance with whatever the campaign, whatever the moment action was, which kind of, I mean, myself liking Sun Ra, but not having any literary background, I can't necessarily unpack the lyrics and the words of Sun Ra to be overtly political.
Right.
I mean, they have this one song that I've heard called Nuclear War, which is just them saying like, don't do it, it sucks, and it's like, okay, that's pretty cut and dry, but it's more kind of what you're getting at, that their performance is this interactive thing. It's more about the moment and the experience as a political either change moment or a socializing moment where you're kind of being brought into the family in a way.
That's right. And let's not forget, too, that, a lot of the, I guess, even Afrofuturism performers reference Sun Ra for reasons that are for those reasons. But also, too, it's really this using performance as a way, of course, of reclaiming Black identity, of course, of maybe seeing seeing life, seeing the current or the future, imagining a new future, right, in the current moment. Sun Ra really did have the belief that you were going to go on an astral journey with him. And you were prepared in that moment to go on that journey with him, and you had to commit to that. So I realize now sort of what an honor that was. And like I said, today's performers are so interesting, and even though they sometimes labels like free jazz or performance is put on these Afrofuturist performers, but they definitely reference what Sun Ra was doing in terms of both resistance but also performance, his cultural work, if you will. So maybe we should play the Gwendolyn Brooks piece, the Golden Shovel piece, which, Gwendolyn Brooks, I think would be considered one of the Black Arts performers, although she sort of predated many of those performers. But she was so influential. So I thought we could play a piece of hers, and then maybe talk a little bit about some of the bands, like these experimental free jazz performance bands that sort of reference her work.
We real cool, the pool players, seven at the golden shovel. We real cool, we left school, we lurk light, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we dice.
So that poem was published in 1959. And her performing that performance piece, I think it was in, it might have been in 1963 or 65, is important. Because when she chose to say that work, is important thing, again, to capture the archive. Where she was reading that work, and then again today, which performers are directly using phrases from her poetry, and in their work as well.
Right. So someone who is not initiated into the literary world, spoken especially, I'm just trying to imagine what that would look like on the page. You know, that it is so much about the flow of the sound of it. You know, you need that vocal range, which is almost unsettling in a way. There's kind of this dissonance going on with the way that she's making the words come out of her mouth. And I'm just trying to think, how could you even get close to understanding that by just reading it?
Of course. It's chant and it's referencing things that you and I, you know, don't have in our historical past or memory. But again, when you hear bands like Heroes Are Gang Leaders, this is an experimental, you could call them a collective coming out of New York, out of Brooklyn. They reference their last work. References Gwendolyn Brooks and is dedicated to Gwendolyn Brooks. We're going to play a piece from them in a minute, but I want to mention that a few other artists working today include, as I mentioned, the Burnt Sugar Orchestra, which I believe actually has members from the Sun Ra Orchestra in it. This woman performer named Moore Mother, she's also working, I believe, out of Philadelphia. She's really working in what you might call experimentalism, this movement. And then sort of earlier, people like Last Poets and even Public Enemy, some people claim as a sort of earlier people who were participating in sort of experimentalism. The mixture of music, art, poetry, ritual, mysticism, and again, always about the participation and being asking the community to participate in those works. So we're going to play a piece that's been recorded, but as you can probably tell, seeing this live must be a totally different experience. So there we have it. Heroes Are Gang Leaders. The name of that song was Final Vinyl. It's from a 2016 EP. that song, Graham, goes on for like 51 minutes.
Not surprised.
And it incorporates these incredible layers of like three different poetry in the work, and then there's a female chorus that comes and goes, and then there's like a soul rhythm track that comes in later, and then you heard the Moogs and the, you know, synthesizers, and they claim, you know, they don't do a lot of post-production. A lot of this work is done live, and so that's Heroes, Our Gang Leaders, and then I mentioned Burnt Sugar. And, of course, Soon Ra, The Last Poets, a lot of these people, their work is recorded, but directly references, like I said, these sort of earlier performers like Gwendolyn Brooks or Amiri Baraka, of course, and Alice Coltrane.
Right.
So,
and I think this is a great little snapshot you've just given us from, I think, the 50s was the first, the Gwendolyn Brooks, didn't you say that was in the 1950s?
1959, yep.
And then all the way up to just within the last few years, from Heroes Are Gang Leaders. That's kind of just one sampling of kind of the history of a movement in the literary tradition, which you have access here to at the University of Connecticut Archives. Just one of the many collections that we focus on. Again, you're listening to Darshiv. This is the radio program where we talk about archives and special collections. We talk about the resources that we have here on campus through the University of Connecticut Library. We're located at the Thomas J. Dodd Research Center. You can come in, ask an archivist anything you want. You can talk to Melissa about the literary collections that we have. If you need help doing research for your term papers, we definitely specialize in university academic research, but we're also a broader research institution that we provide access to anyone anywhere in the world. International scholars come to do research with us all the time. You can also find information about us and our digital work, our resources on the web at archives.lib.ucon.edu. Again, we're speaking with Melissa Waterworth Batt, archivist of the Literary and Natural History Collections, and today we're talking about the Black Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And as you'd mentioned, some of the other bands that have really drawn from these literary traditions, mentioning like Public Enemy, for example, and in my experience with the alternative press collections that we have, which have these punk rock collections
That's right.
Yeah. There's so many correlations, I feel like, between this time in the 1980s. The aesthetics are starting to change. They're grabbing from older traditions.
Mm-hmm.
The political statements seem almost the same. I mean, there are all kinds of codes within these subcultures and art forms. But the aesthetics of Public Enemy, I think of, you know, gigantic medallions, like not gold medallions, but ones that are almost harkening back to this Pan-African movement, which, you know, has its earlier iterations, maybe in the Harlem Renaissance, other kinds of additions to that. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about maybe how some of these art forms were restricted in their production to start off with.
You
mentioned Audre Lorde, you know, producing and creating.
Mm-hmm.
If you could talk a little bit about that.
Right. That is such a part of, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, sort of talking about how the artistic practices and writing that's from the 1970s and 80s are completely being revisited today and reperformed. And it is, that's right, Graham, that one thing that we have to remind students using this work and coming into the archive to view the work is that independent culture production really happened, of course, because artists wanted to control the means of how their work is produced and distributed. But of course, many artists, like you said, weren't given a choice. Publishers didn't want to publish Audre Lorde's work, or let's say a lot of commercial publishers didn't want to publish political work or what they thought would be political resistance, poetry or lyrics or transgressive, sort of what they considered transgressive arts. So a lot of artists and writers like Audre Lorde, who was also a lesbian, she wanted to publish not only her own work, but the work of other lesbians, particularly and other radical feminists. So Out and Out Books was one small press that I think she helped found. But we do in the archive really seek out trying to collect these small press publications. Mm-hmm. And in terms of Amiri Baraka, he very much started several presses in his lifetime. And I mentioned to you, too, that during the Black Arts Movement, he really was trying to work in writing Black theater and plays. That work is very much difficult to find. And again, we have to rely on these underground press materials to document that these performances took place and who attended and some of the reviews. People seek out these alternative places, these places not only to perform their art, but to distribute their work. And then again, to ask the audience to participate in this work. And we can't forget that we want to contextualize that original work. True, sometimes, for instance, in Gwendolyn Brooks's case, the editors that published her work in Poetry, which was it was produced and distributed to every academic library, you know, in the country, they made choices about what work of hers they wanted to publish. And then finally when she got involved with the Black Arts Movement, she became much more of a multi-dimensional artist using spoken word, doing readings at protests and other teaching Black kids mm-hmm. to write creative writing. Again, mm-hmm. that kind of work was happening with these poets, and we have to try to document them
right.
All together.
And kind of coming back to this, we'd talked a little bit about performance. You know, you talked about sometimes these things being spontaneous. And I know this question kind of runs counter to what an archive is, but I'm just wondering, what would you say, coming from a background in poetry and literary mm-hmm. collecting, you know, what is lost that we don't have when we're thinking of work that is an audio recording, it's either live or it's written? I mean, what really... What can't be gathered in a way? What cannot be recorded?
Of course, a couple of things. I think it depends on the frame or the lens that you're looking and consuming these artists through. But I think what we just mentioned, for instance, erasure, we want to be sure to say not erase the resistance or the struggle of the artist. We don't want to, of course, de-emphasize the space in which the work took place. So if it was happening concurrently with a march, with a Black piece of theater, or in the case of AIDS activism, in these sort of, you know, poems were being read in parks, in galleries, at historical monuments as a way of getting the AIDS messages across, and people who are dying from AIDS, sort of calling to action other people in the community. Yeah, that's what we don't want to lose mm-hmm. is not just the historical context of the work, but also the struggles and the relationships of people who tried to bring this work to their audiences. And right, we can use recordings, we can use letters between artists, and of course these small press publications or underground, what we're called underground press publications. We could try to include those, of course, in the archives so that people understand. Again, I'm saying the archival document is much wider and diverse. I don't know, what do you think? Do you think there's other ways we could, I don't know, do we educate people about the time period, or mm-hmm. do we, as we've mentioned before, just let students come in and on their own terms sort of explore the archive?
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's part of, it's part of this larger mission of making sure that archives have relevance to current issues.
Of course, right.
And making sure that we can highlight these moments when they relate to the historical precedents that have been set, you know, out of all of our collective memory, but that's why the archives is there, to kind of be the historical memory. And just thinking through, you know, kind of what's been happening lately with demonstrations around monuments
Sort
of what these symbols look like on the landscape. You know, that's just one site of where history has sort of made its stamp on the ground. And then we have counter demonstration against that kind of memory and that kind of memorialization. And if that's all that we ever see, you know,
right.
we don't really have the full picture of when, why, how,
right.
what for. So documenting, you know, these kinds of performances like Sun Ra at a demonstration somewhere, you know, someone might remember that that happened, but we need to make sure that we can have a recorded document
That's right.
to continue this, especially if the work of monumental creation is not in the hands of everyone or communities necessarily,
yep.
but
mm-hmm.
kind of always relying on someone else to put something up about
right.
history, which makes the archives job all the more important,
mm-hmm.
I feel.
Mm-hmm.
Not to toot our own horns, but there is an element of power in,
of course,
in what
yep.
it is that we bring in.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you find most engaging about the collections that you have.
Well, we could probably talk, how about maybe just I'll mention a few really recent additions to the collection,
please.
Graham. And maybe you could join in too. We've been bringing in, say, graphic novels. So literary production is really in many different formats, as you know. So graphic novels and comics. Graphic novels are terrific for, say, documenting the experience of refugees or even of displaced people. We bring in materials like, let's see, the papers of activists, not just the papers of activists, right, Graham, but the tools of their trade. So we want to be sure to make sure the archive reflects not only their work, but also their practice.
Right.
Other things we've been bringing in are, I mentioned some of the Harlem Renaissance writers. They're being sort of recontextualized as we speak and rediscovered, and we want to be sure that even though they pretty much were published in we want to understand that the editorial practices taking place at the time that they were being published. And I'm trying to think. Oh, artist books. You know,
mm-hmm.
we bring in these artist books. Sometimes these are unique works of art where artists, activists, and collaborate to create a unique piece that speaks to today. Sometimes it can take multiple social or political issues and allow the readers and students to see those topics today in a different way. And
right.
to engage in a much more visceral way.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes maybe more directly than consuming, say, other types of social media, right?
And I feel like these kinds of collections, the artist books, the printmaking, the street art that we've been bringing in,
mm-hmm.
This really ties in a lot to what you've been talking about today with the role of performance in the literary tradition and trying to, you know, figure out a way to capture this stuff in a way. Not capture as in like imprison in the archive,
right,
but capture as in we want a snapshot of this
right.
so that you can come by and take your own scraping of it and then mm-hmm. convert it into your own performative
That's
work.
That's right. That's right.
And yeah, kind of thinking through the broader implications of, you know, how we physically bring things in, but then also filling gaps. I think a lot of the work that you've been doing and collecting lately to try and, you know, double down on bringing in Harlem Renaissance writers
mm-hmm.
has a lot to do with what wasn't collected,
mm-hmm.
you know. So again, this notion of erasure may not have taken a purposeful path where you're not collecting very specifically things about, you know, black authors in the 50s mm-hmm. and 40s and earlier, but it just was not the priority. And so now you're having to
reimagine
why we collect things in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes these works are very hard to find. Mm-hmm. So we do encourage our, we have to encourage people in our community to give, to donate, to help us build this collection. And that goes for the students as well. I should just quickly mention, we do archive students' work in different forms, not just their writing and their poetry, but of course their artwork, their prints, their publications. So students should know too that is of course an area that we're building in the collection as well. Let's see, Graham, something you mentioned, I want to reiterate, we're asking students to come in and reinterpret, to guest curate their own exhibitions, to build their own Instagram, feeds based on their experience in the archives. And it's really just, I think, today's way that young people can engage with the archive and that we encourage. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And on the radio, we hope it doesn't fall too flat, but...
Now, this is the work we're trying to do is, like you'd said, just... creating more moments for engagement, mm-hmm. and making mm-hmm. sure that everybody knows that, again, the archives and special collections are part of the resources that we have here at the university. As a function of the library in and of itself, we have special collections that we've intentionally gone about building strength in mm-hmm. particular areas. You can find out further information about us at archives.lib.ucon.edu. Melissa, do you have a quote for us that you wanted to?
I do.
Do you want to read that?
I can't stress enough, I think, encouraging people to come in and listen to poets in their own voices, to engage with artists in their own, I would say, some of their original medium. It sounds very flat, but that's why I picked this quote. Moore Mother is a Philadelphia-based artist, and she works, I think, in what you might call sort of the black avant-garde. But she's got this great quote in a recent interview that I wanted to leave everyone with. So I'll read that for you. Free jazz, to me, is the beginning and its expansion. It is in the chants on top of foot stomps and hand claps. It is the scripture over top of the choir. Free jazz is what is needed to travel. It's the sound of protest, of peace, and of sorrow all at the same time. You cannot go to war without a drum. You cannot time travel or seek outer and inner dimensions without free jazz. Alice Coltrane, her music is a liberation technology. Sun Ra, his music is a liberation technology. That's why I love Amiri Baraka so much. He put jazz into the poetry, because if you need to go to a certain place, that is the only way.
Wow. Love that.
So Moore Mother, and we can use her words as inspiration for today's show.
That's great. Thank you so much, Melissa.
Thank you, Graham,
joining us on this journey through the literary collections that we have at the Archives and Special Collections. Again, you're listening to Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. We'll be coming back to you next week with more topics, audio recordings, archivist chit-chat about archives, information, memory, and the resources that we have here at the University of Connecticut. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.